devastation and grief in the Golan Heights.
They were buried yesterday, 11 of them, in a mass funeral. One of the children was still missing until this morning. They hadn't found the body, although they did, and his funeral was held today.
Plus, Nicolas Maduro declares victory in Venezuela.
The people were not able to monitor the counting, which is part of the process, and it should have been able to get in.
And later, an update from Kyiv and a look at President Joe Biden's ideas on Supreme Court reform. Today is Monday, July 29th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel struck Hezbollah targets in Lebanon on Sunday in the immediate aftermath of a rocket strike from Lebanon that killed 12 people at a football field in the Golan Heights. Sunday's strikes were aimed at what the Israeli military said were Hezbollah weapons caches and infrastructure. Lebanon's state-run news agency reported extensive damage as well as some casualties, but the strike seemed to fall short of the overwhelming response that Israel had threatened after the Saturday attack on a soccer field that killed teenagers and young children. The victims of the strike were Druze Arabs. They're a minority in Israel that's neither Jewish nor Muslim, but they are Israeli citizens. Thousands of Druze Arabs observed a day of mourning on Sunday in the Golan Heights, shutting shops and other workplaces. Many went by bus to attend the funerals of those killed. Joining me now for the latest is VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, the latest is that there's a lot of tension between Israel and Hezbollah, with Israel saying that it's going to retaliate and Hezbollah and Iran warning that if Israel does, it will also retaliate. And there are fears that it could escalate into a war. The missile was an Iranian missile. Hezbollah is continuing to say that it did not fire the missile, but both the U.S. and Israel say that they are sure that it was fired by Hezbollah.
Now, from what we understand, the village that was hit was largely inhabited by the Druze people, not necessarily Israeli Jews. Is there any reason to think that they were specifically targeted?
No, definitely not. It's a it's the name of the village is Majdal Shems. It's a village in the Golan Heights, near the border between Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. In this case, it's closer to the border with Lebanon. And Israeli military analysts said their best guess is that there are several military outposts in that area, and that they were aiming for the outposts and just misfired.
I can imagine the grief in the village after a dozen children were killed. What's it like there?
Oh, it's just awful. I mean, it's very, very sad. They were buried yesterday, 11 of them, in a mass funeral. One of the children was still missing until this morning. They hadn't found the body, although they did, and his funeral was held today. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the village, and there were a lot of angry people there and feeling that he didn't do enough to protect them.
You know, we have this interview, it seems like, once a week, where there is an attack across the border one way or another, both sides saying they don't want to see it escalated, both sides saying they don't want to see a war, yet this doesn't stop. Is there any sense that this is bigger than any attack before, and therefore there will be a stronger attack, which might actually lead to an all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah?
There's definitely a sense that this is stronger. I think we've even spoken about it where I said a miscalculation on either side that hits a school or hits a soccer field and you've got a bunch of children killed is going to provoke a response from the other side. It seems that the Israeli response will be a question. It's not if, it's when. The United States has been trying to convince Israel to respond, but not go too far. But the sense is that the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah is tied to the war in Gaza, and that if there were a ceasefire in between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, the low conflict between Israel and Hezbollah would stop. Both Israel and Hezbollah have really tried to attack military targets rather than trying to attack civilians. That said, Hezbollah is believed to have something like 150,000 rockets and missiles that can reach all parts of Israel. And if it does escalate into an all-out war, there's going to be a sort of heavy price on both sides.
Israel, Lebanon, and Hezbollah may not want a war, but it appears that Iran might. Is there any sense of retaliating against Tehran?
So, you know, the question is what does Iran want to do? And I'm just not sure of what that is. And I think that's something that we'll see. But even, in other words, Israel has said that it would see all of Lebanon as a target. Hezbollah keeps repeating that it doesn't want a war. You know, I don't know. So I really don't know what Iran's intentions are.
VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting on this.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
Changing gears now, Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country may deploy new strike weapons in response to an American plan to place missiles in Germany. Both the U.S. and Russia recently signaled a readiness to deploy intermediate-range weapons that were banned for decades under a Cold War-era treaty. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Sunday in St. Petersburg, Russian state television broadcast footage of the country's fleets at the annual Navy Day celebration. In attendance were officers from 31 other countries, including China, India, Iran, and South Africa. Showcasing the Russian Navy, missiles fired from various ships of the Black Sea Fleet, and jets dropped bombs from above. Overshadowing Russia's pomp and circumstance of the day is a recent plan revealed by the United States to deploy long-range missiles to Germany by 2026. To outside observers, as well as Russian President Vladimir Putin, this may be history repeating itself.
The situation recalls of the events of the Cold War era. If the U.S. implements such plans, we will consider ourselves free from the previous imposed one-sided moratorium on the development of the medium and short-range strike system. We will take mirror measures for their development.
In a recent joint statement from the White House, U.S. and German officials said exercising advanced capabilities would demonstrate a commitment to NATO and its contributions to European integrated deterrence. Despite the Kremlin's latest round of saber-rattling, the Russian Defense Ministry began releasing videos showcasing intercontinental ballistic missile tests days before its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Putin at the time discussed plans to assemble his army's so-called deterrent force to potentially include a nuclear component. It is language that NATO calls dangerous and irresponsible. Since the onset of the Russian invasion, Western powers have by far been Ukraine's largest supporters in terms of money and material. NATO members recently pledged an additional $43 billion next year, with plans for sustained support to follow.
All of this support will make Ukraine stronger and more capable. In fact, everything we are doing, the command, the pledge, more military aid, more security agreements, and improved interoperability, put in place the foundations for Ukraine to prevail.
While St. Petersburg seemed pleased by its military display, experts worry the readiness of both Russia and the U.S. to deploy intermediate-range weapons could spark a new arms race. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And elsewhere in Europe, the administration is announcing new security assistance package for Ukraine, including air defense interceptors, HIMARS artillery munitions, mortar rounds, Javelin anti-tank missiles, and more. All this, according to White House advisor John Kirby. Meanwhile, the Russian military is focusing fierce attacks on a key Ukrainian supply route near the eastern city of Pokrovsk. A Ukrainian military official said Monday its army had fought off 52 Russian assaults there in the last 24 hours. VOA's Lori London gets an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
So for the past months, Ukrainian forces are trying to keep the defense line in the direction of the city of Pokrovsk in that area in the Donetsk region, because this is definitely one of the strategic points in terms of the logistics, in terms of the control of the region, of this of the territory in the region in general. So we do see that Russian forces are concentrating very big amount of manpower, of equipment, and Pokrovsk direction remains the spotlight for this all this time. And President Zelensky is visiting the city of Kharkiv on Monday, and this is also one of the reasons why he is currently present in the eastern part of the country. President Zelensky is having military meetings with Ukrainian armed forces personnel close to the front line, and the main topic of discussion is definitely the ongoing assault by the Russian forces, the defense plans of Ukraine, and also energy situation in the region.
Russian assaults have been continuing to target Ukraine's energy sector. Is it still a pretty serious situation as far as the power grid?
Energy situation remains extremely tough across the country. Currently, over the weekend and the upcoming week, it is expected the situation will be slightly better, but repair works are ongoing, and some of the stations of the blocks of some of the nuclear power plants were back to the operation. But situation is tough, especially it is getting much tougher as we are moving closer to the front line, and Kharkiv region particularly is really pretty bad.
And I understand there were drone attacks in Russia. I would imagine that would be coming from Ukraine?
So yeah, over the weekend we're hearing about a couple of drone attacks. In particular, there was a report about at least 39 drones attacking the power station on the territory of Russia. It was reported by the Russian authorities. Even Russian authorities say that all drones were destroyed. However, there are reports and footage from that area that actually certain power blocks were damaged, and the fire could be seen in there. Also, another drone attack was targeting the oil depot on the territory of Russia as well. And this attack was actually confirmed also by the Ukrainian authorities. It was said by the Ukrainian military that the Ukrainian special forces were actually in charge of the operation. And actually, also Russian authorities report the damage of the oil depot, and there are footage also of the area being on fire. How severe the damage is at this point, we cannot have this information independently verified. But according to, again, Ukrainian and Russian authorities, it seems that a Ukrainian attack was partially successful.
Lori London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine here on the Voice of America. She was speaking with our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova. You are listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro won election to a new term, the country's election authority said early Monday, after a vote in which the opposition had also expressed confidence that it won. The National Electoral Council released its results 6 hours after polls closed, saying Maduro had 51% of the vote, compared to 44% for opposition candidate Edmundo González. However, the results did not include vote tallies from individual polling centers. Speaking to a rally of supporters early Monday, Maduro promised peace and security. And without naming the United States directly, he lashed out at foreign critics and foes.
A triumph of the national independency, the dignity of the Venezuelan people. The sanctions made weren't enough. Aggressions against weren't enough. Threats weren't enough. Not today. And those will never be enough against the dignity of the Venezuelan people.
Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado rejected the election authority's result, saying instead that González had won 70% of the vote.
In the coming days, we'll keep on announcing the actions we'll take to defend the truth, because we've said this, until the end is until the end, and the end will be the truth coming through, and respect for the popular sovereignty that spoke today and chose Edmundo González Urrutia as the next president of Venezuela.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Monday while in Japan that Washington has serious concerns that the Venezuelan election result declaring Maduro the winner is not accurate, and it does not reflect the will of the votes of the Venezuelan people. Other regional leaders have also expressed their doubts about Maduro's victory. Joining me now is Celia Mendoza of VOA's Latin American service.
The shadow that is cast over their election is not recent, is the result of a long-prolonged erosion of the division of powers, the control that has had the government of Venezuela, in this case, initially Chavez, eventually took takeover by Nicolas Maduro within an election that also was questioned against Enrique Capriles. And since then, we have seen a decline on the capability of Venezuelans to trust their government. But also at the same time, during the election yesterday, we were able to hear complaints that our team on the ground was able to register how the people were not able to monitor the counting, which is part of the process, and it should have been able to get in and some of the locations to be witnesses of the process. And the government also claimed that it was a cyber attack and overnight that created delays on that. So the problem that Venezuela has is the history of a power-grabbing government, according to international organizations and even the United States. And what they were trying to do with this election, or that's what was the hope of the international community, was to try to regain a democratic path in which a fair and transparent election was able to be conducted. So in the case of Venezuela, is a lot of evidence documented by international courts and international organizations independent from any government, like the United Nations in particular, and some of their agencies. They have documented the violations.
Celia Mendoza of VOA's Latin American service. Celia, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you so much.
And finally today, U.S. President Joe Biden wrote an editorial in today's Washington Post calling for Supreme Court reform. This follows years of important court victories for conservatives, many including the reversal of Roe v. Wade, the end of the Chevron deference, and most recently the declaration of broad presidential immunity, have dramatically changed the law of the land. For more, I'm joined by constitutional law professor Cliff Sloan of Georgetown University's Law School.
I do think he's right. I think there is a real crisis with public confidence and trust and faith in the Supreme Court. First of all, we've had unprecedented ethics scandals at the Supreme Court, with justices receiving lucrative benefits, very fancy vacations, private plane rides, including in one instance from somebody who later had cases before the Supreme Court, with very little accountability. And that's all. And it's also happening at a time when the justices are very rapidly throwing out decisions that have been in place for decades that protect people's rights, and including with this very radical new immunity decision. And you have a situation where there were very questionable circumstances about the composition of the current Supreme Court, where the Senate Republicans refused to consider President Obama's Supreme Court nomination, even to consider it for a full year, so that effectively they could pack the court.
Well, it seems that President Biden shares your opinion. He's written in his op-ed that was published today that there is a crisis of confidence, that things are not all right with the Supreme Court. And he's making three suggestions for improvement. One is a constitutional amendment, basically undoing the decision about presidential immunity, saying that no president would be immune from crimes committed while in office. The second suggestion would be term limits for judges, which would be a big change from the way things are now. And the third is that binding code of ethics, which other federal judges are subject to, but the Supreme Court is not. Do you think that's simply a good place to start, or do you think that might restore the confidence that the court seems to have lost?
I think those three initiatives would all be very, very helpful in restoring trust and confidence in the Supreme Court. And take them one by one. The immunity decision that the Supreme Court issued is completely contrary to everything that we've understood in our history, which is that presidents are subject to the law like everybody else. And what the Supreme Court did was a radical departure that's really quite shocking. And in terms of 18-year terms for the justices, you know, that's something that has gotten broad support across the political spectrum. It's one of the sort of rare ideas that conservatives and liberals and centrists all have agreed on, because it makes so much sense in terms of taking some of the toxic nature out of the Supreme Court nomination and confirmation process. And in terms of a binding ethics code with some compliance mechanism, I mean, again, that's just something everybody can understand that. Of course, there should be that for the justices. In every other part of government, in every other part of life, everybody understands that, you know, there are binding ethics rules, and it can't be the situation that the Supreme Court's justices are the only people in government and really almost the only people in the country who are not bound by ethical requirements. So I think all three of these initiatives are very valuable, and I think they all would help in terms of kind of restoring public trust and confidence in the Supreme Court.
Now, how much of President Biden's opinions that are expressed in this editorial are solid legal thoughts that have been bandied about for a while and are out there in the public discussion? And how much of it do you think is just sour grapes? Because honestly, he's lost several cases in a row.
Well, I think these are all well-founded. Now, you know, two of the three, the 18-year term and the binding, the need for a binding ethics code, those have both been extensively discussed and considered, and I think are on very strong legal ground. Now, the immunity constitutional amendment that President Biden is proposing to overturn the court's sweeping decision on presidential immunity, that's relatively new because the Supreme Court decision is relatively new.
How does something like this happen? Does Congress have to pass laws? Couldn't then somebody challenge those laws and take them to the Supreme Court, where essentially the Supreme Court would be making the decisions for their own rules? How would we get something like this to actually happen?
Right. And that's where the big challenges come in, because all three of them, in different ways, first of all, will require congressional action. And of course, right now, we've got a divided Congress. We've got a very polarized political environment. So a constitutional amendment, which is President Biden's first proposal on immunity, that requires two-thirds approval of both houses, and then approval by three-quarters of the states, because it would be a constitutional amendment. That's a very, very high burden. It's very difficult to get a constitutional amendment passed. And again, especially in this political climate and context. Now, the 18-year term and the binding ethics code would both require congressional legislation again, and again, they would face the same challenges. As to both of those, there are critics who say that they would be unconstitutional. And so even if somehow they would get through Congress, there very well could be constitutional challenges. And as you say, they might end up in the Supreme Court. Now, I don't think that the constitutional objections to them are well-founded, but again, there are those who disagree, and so there would be constitutional challenges to them. But again, the most immediate, very major problem would be to get these through Congress.
Cliff Sloan is a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. Professor Sloan, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.